From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson, in This Week for Michael Krasny. Jen Null knows all about jet streams and the winds aloft, but the well-known Bay Area weather forecaster first experienced swirling winds in a very different capacity, manning a machine gun aboard a helicopter during the Vietnam War. Today, you see him quoted in just about every article about El Nino, but how he got to be everyone's favorite expert on everything from El Nino to La Nina, from heat stroke to hail, makes for a good story. And Jen Null joins us next as part of Forum's first-person series, where we profile the leaders, innovators, and others who help make the Bay Area unique. That's next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson, in This Week for Michael Krasny. An El Nino-driven storm is sort of like the favorite uncle who hasn't visited in a long time. We think we know him. We totally want to see him. But we can't quite recall what he looks like or what he actually does. In recent weeks, whenever we've heard the sound of rain outside, we've run to the doorway and looked outside. Is this the rain that finally heralds his arrival? Is he here yet? It's the question Jen Null, the Bay Area's most quoted meteorologist, hears most. What is El Nino and when will it get here? This morning, he joins us to talk about El Nino and all matters meteorological. He was a longtime forecaster for the National Weather Service before founding his own weather consulting company, Golden Gate Weather Services. He not only knows his way around a forecast, he also consults with energy companies, conducts research on the impact of heat stroke on children, testifies as an expert witness as well. He joins us on this rainy Wednesday morning as part of our first-person interview series where we feature the leaders and innovators who help make the Bay Area unique. Jen Null, good morning.
Thank you, Dave.
It's a pleasure to have you here. So is it here yet? Is it here yet?
Well, it certainly is an apropos day to be talking about it with the bands of rain moving through the Bay Area. These are the sort of weather system that, you know, we look at if we were to do like a textbook image of what the weather pattern is during El Nino. That certainly is what we're in now. That being said, though, we've been feeling the influence of El Nino since back in the fall. El Nino, you know, began forming actually a year ago, and it really has gotten going during the fall and now into the winter months. So it has been causing impacts. For example, probably some of the warm weather at Christmas time back in the east was somewhat influenced by the fact that there's El Nino. So everything going on sort of has a little bit of El Nino DNA in it. The current pattern we're in right now has it's a real close uncle instead of a distant cousin like some of the other events.
Maybe part of the question we ought to answer first is sort of what the it is, because I know it bothers you when people say like the El Nino storm, because El Nino really isn't a storm. So take us back and give us a little bit of sort of what we really ought to most understand about what El Nino, what the it actually is.
Sure. Yeah. And your point is good right off the bat, because it's never going to be a storm we're going to look out, you know, stand on the Marin headlands or look at radar or satellite and say, oh, that's El Nino. What El Nino is a periodic warming of the waters in the eastern tropical Pacific Ocean, so about 3,000 miles away. So that's where I answer question number one is, does El Nino come to California? No, El Nino is a tropical event. But when it occurs, it causes changes in global weather patterns. Other than the seasons, it's probably the strongest impact upon the seasonal changes that we're going to see. And so as it shifts and it gets into place, it affects where the jet stream is, where the storm track is. And oftentimes, you know, that then leads to a change in the weather patterns for California. And especially with these very strong El Nino events, by strong, I mean the waters in that tropical Pacific are much warmer than normal. That is then what leads us into these above normal rainfall years. And we're hoping that this year will mirror the other very strong El Ninos that we have seen back from 1982-83 winter and the 1997-98 winter.
So is, in essence, El Nino a kind of phenomenon that winds up acting like a delivery service? It's sort of the Federal Express that brings us more?
Yes, it is a, it sort of... is the background sort of for the FedEx of weather. It's not going to actually deliver it, but it's going to pave the freeway so that FedEx can get to your house faster and with more rain.
And what makes, you know, we're all so eager for this to replicate 97, 98 or 82.3 as you referenced. Say something about the variations in El Niños, because not all El Niños are alike, right? So why do we think this one will pack more punch or deliver more to us?
Yeah, there is a broad spectrum of what happens during years when there is El Niño. And that spectrum changes the more the waters of the tropical Pacific warm up and we get what we call stronger and stronger events. We have had some El Niño years with weaker events that have been drier than normal. One of the drought years of the 70s was an El Niño year. Hmm. If we look at the entire, you know, range of occurrences from rainfall, only about a third are above normal during El Niño years. But those are much above normal. And again, the 82 and the 97 events were in that very strong category. So the strength of that El Niño really is a bigger driver in the atmosphere and has a greater impact upon the storm track.
Jen Null is our guest, the legendary Bay Area meteorologist, joining us as part of our first-person interview series here on Forum this morning. We really want to hear from you, too. What are the weather questions, El Niño or not, that you've really been dying to ask? You can join us this hour. You can call us a bit later at 866-733-6786. You can email us your thoughts at forum@kqed.org. Post them on our website, kqed.org/forum, or on our Facebook page as well. Are you convinced that this will be the winter that we all want? I am obsessed with looking at the rainfall totals every morning, and I'm always reminded this year that we've actually only had about half the rainfall that we did a year ago because we got clobbered last December, and then everything stopped. So I live in fear that everything's going to stop. Are you convinced that this is here for the duration this winter?
I'm not 100% convinced, but I'm 90%, you know, in the camp that we are going to have an above normal rainfall year. And then we have to be looking at, okay, well, how much above normal? If we just get a normal year or even slightly above normal year, the impact that that's going to have upon the huge rainfall deficits that we have for the last 4 years of drought are going to be minimal. If we can replicate the amounts of rainfall we saw in 82 and 97, where we had 150 to 200% of normal rainfall, the average rainfall, then we're going to be able to see a much greater impact.
What about the worries then about the sort of downside, if there is one, of a super a lot of El Niño-driven storms affecting us this winter? Because people, I was already reading this morning, worrying about floods or flood watches in different parts of the Bay Area. I know you've made the point that El Niño-driven storms, though, are not necessarily what's going to create havoc on the Russian River or elsewhere. Why is that?
Right. Well, the types of storms that give us the biggest flood events, like, you know, 86 up on the Russian River, or some of the big floods on the Sacramento River, those are most often related to what we call atmospheric rivers, or the colloquial term has been the pineapple conduction. When we tap into that warm tropical air from down the vicinity of the Hawaiian Islands, thus the pineapple conduction name, and that sits over one portion of the state for an extended period of time, dumping lots of rain. And, you know, any time you have a persistent pattern in weather, be it an extended hot spell or an extended wet period, that's when you start seeing extremes as far as damage and other effects. What we have often seen with El Niño, and we're seeing now, is not one big storm where it sits over an area for an extended period of time. It are the series of storms are lined up across the Pacific. I referred to it the other day as a conga line of storms, because you look at a satellite image of the whole Pacific, and there's like four individual storms just lined up from Japan all the way to California and moving through about every 24 or 36 hours, giving us some rain, a little bit of time to dry out, giving us some more rain. And in 1997, you know, while we had approximately twice our normal rainfall, that was spread over about twice the number of normal rainy days. So there was not actually, you know, contrary to what a lot of the hyperbole has been, a lot of flooding that year. There were a lot of mudslides. There was some localized damage, localized flooding. But as far as big, main, hugely damaging floods, that was not the case.
Are you like the happiest guy in the Bay Area right now with lots of weather going on? Is this a time when a meteorologist is just kind of rubbing their hands with glee?
Yes. You know, probably the most depressing thing for a meteorologist is a drought. You know, let's watch the paint dry also. You know, it's a very slow-moving event. Yeah, we can look at the statistics and is this the driest ever? But most meteorologists like the dynamics of seeing what the atmosphere could do, trying to predict it, look at what those impacts are.
What drew you to this field? What drew you in? Was it something you thought about as a kid? Was it later? I know you had this experience in Vietnam where weather was sometimes affected very much, kind of life and death situations. What brought you to pursuing this career?
I was always a math and science guy. I originally had thought that I was going to be a physics teacher. And then I sort of branched over to astronomy and realized in short order that there were not a lot of jobs or opportunities in astronomy. And then I had gone up to University of California at Davis and had actually seen one of these flyers they have in the Student Union building for the Department of Atmospheric Science. And, I'd always been kind of interested in weather. I was not one of these people like a lot of meteorologists or weather aficionados are, you know, that started at age six keeping track of rainfall in their backyard. But I always had an interest in the science of it. And so as I got more and more into that program, it just really resonated with the sorts of things that I like. And probably the biggest thing, for example, the sorts of education you need are very similar to what you need to be like an engineer. You need a lot of math and science. But instead of building a bridge and seeing it falls down in 100 years, you can see the outcome of your weather forecast in the next 24 hours or the next week or something like that. I like that real-time aspect.
Is it going to be a growth industry? You know, I'm thinking automatically of people thinking about jobs in the future and everyone, you know, who has young adults for children is sort of paranoid about what they're going to do. And those young adults are paranoid about what they're going to do. Is meteorology a great growth potential? I think about how this is a time when climate, and I know that's a somewhat different field, it is so central to so many aspects of our lives.
It is, but contrarily, what is happening, so much of the weather production of, especially for, you know, for the internet, for iPhone and, you know, Google apps and things like that are done by computers. Hmm. So meteorological companies, they are hiring people less as meteorologists and more as people with expertise in programming that meteorology and making it come out of the computer. So the handcrafted sort of meteorology, I don't see much growth in that. If anything, it may be sort of in a decline as it's replaced by people reaching their phone and looking at their app.
Hmm. We'll hear more of Jen Null's story, what he does now and all the things that he's engaged in beyond El Nino, including his work as an expert witness and how he consults with renewable energy companies and the like as we go through our hour. But we have calls lined up like a conga line here with people who want to talk to you about El Nino and other storm-related events. And so we'll start taking some of those as well. Joy joins us first in Berkeley. Joy, go ahead, please.
Expert witness and how he consults with renewable energy companies.
And turn down your radio, if you would, Joy, because we're getting a little bit of feedback from that. Joy, if you're on, go ahead.
Conga line here with people who want it.
I guess not. All right, Joy, call us again. Come back to us at another point. Kate in Sebastopol is with us. Kate, go ahead.
Yeah, hi. We know there's some cloud seeding and all that sort of activity. Geoengineering, can you talk about its effects on the weather? David Keith, a government spokesperson, is advocating massive geoengineering globally.
And Kate, say just a bit more about what you mean by geoengineering, please.
Well, there's several levels. We have cloud seeding for making snow, lots of reports about that, making rain. Also, you're talking about geoengineering the planet to manage solar radiation. In other words, reflect the
Okay, I get the drift of where you're going. Is that much of a phenomenon, General?
You know, it's not one that is, you know, it certainly is dealt with on a day-to-day basis. The weather modification or cloud seeding, there have been active programs in the Sierras and the Shasta area for literally decades. The amount of increase from cloud seeding is probably in the order of increasing maybe only 5 or 10%. And you have to keep that in the context that you can only see the cloud that's going to rain or snow anyway. So that was not a factor back during the drought. As far as a lot of the other geoengineering controversies out there, most of them fall into the conspiracy theory category. As from what I have read, I haven't been seeing this in the good refereed literature.
Thought as much. Nick in Mill Valley. Go ahead, Nick.
Good morning. Thank you for this interesting talk this morning. I have an 8-year-old turning 9-year-old very shortly. He was extremely interested in weather. He monitors the weather daily all over the world, from places in Greenland to local precipitation, comma clouds, satellite imagery. Can you recommend either books or websites or other sources that would sort of continue to pique his interest and that we could use as sort of educational tools for him? Thank you.
Sure. You know, a really good layperson's weather magazine is called WeatherWise. You can find it online at weatherwise.org. I actually periodically write for them, but it has good layperson articles on a whole variety of topics. The current cover topic was one I wrote about El Nino. And so that, you know, that's a good source. I might be a little over the head of an 8-year-old right now. There are, you know, just tons of educational websites from both NOAA and from NASA. One is called SciJinx, and good educational sorts of things that get people ramped up as they grow.
Would another thing be to just make sure your kids get out in the weather? I mean, and experience it.
Yes, and it's amazing. I mean, I have seen parents showing their kids, this is what rain looks like,
right.
You know. And so, but getting out and, you know, maybe on a day when he's been looking at some weather reports, and you know, it's 30 miles an hour. Take him up to the Marin Headland so he can feel what 30 miles an hour really feels like.
Great point. Question from a listener. When we think of El Nino bringing us rain, in Indonesia, El Nino is actually bringing record heat and forest fires, compounding deforestation. Is El Nino just moving around the winter rains? How does it bring rain to one area and record heat to another? You mentioned the factor of what was going on back east. I was back east with my family, daughter and grandchildren at Christmas time, and it was 10 degrees warmer in New England than it was here.
Sure. Yeah. Well, what happens during, a typical sort of El Nino is as the warm waters in the tropical Pacific shift into the eastern Pacific, that means we have colder water and less convection, less thunderstorms in the western Pacific, and that includes Indonesia and parts of Australia. And when that happens, their rainfall shuts off in those areas, those normally tropical areas. So while we shift the pattern into a normally wetter one here, it shifts it into a drier pattern there. And that we see that replicated in other parts of the world, too, where you have this shift during a year when there's El Nino. The Atlantic hurricane season, due to the increased jet stream, becomes a very minimal event in most El Nino years, while the Eastern Pacific hurricane season off the coast of Mexico goes gangbusters, and we saw that this year. So lots of different impacts.
I'm sure it's hard to tease out, but this makes me curious about the interplay, or if there is an interplay, between El Nino or La Nina, which we haven't talked about that yet, the kind of counter phenomenon of drier years, and the broader question of climate change, because we certainly have heard associations with more severe weather being associated with climate change. Is there an interplay there? Is it important to tease them out?
you know, there is an interplay. What we don't know is how yet to quantify that. Just as I had mentioned, you know, that every storm this year has some, you know, has some El Nino DNA in it. You know, it's being influenced in some factor. The fact that we have a warmer atmosphere, warmer oceans are also, you know, that's going to impact, for example, probably the strengths that we see with El Niños going forward and other weather events. So it's all tied together. But so almost any weather event, be it severe weather, even normal weather, is going to have some, you know, some global warming DNA in it.
Brings me to a question here from a listener. Can you pick out a region that will still have livable weather and plenty of water after the climate change apocalypse?
Well, I think of an apocalypse as a much more rapid sort of event. I mean, this is going to be something that we are going to, you know, be, you know, seeing these very incremental changes on for the next 50 or 100 years. So the livable areas, you know, that we have now most likely will shift north somewhat. But I'm also seeing that, you know, that we will be able to adapt in that amount of time. I mean, you know, the human species is a very adaptable species. To make maybe those areas that we would not think are livable will become livable.
We will continue our conversation after we take a short break. Jack is online wanting to talk about whether or not we're coming to a tipping point in weather historically. And so we'll take that up when we come back. We also have questions coming in about fog, about the jet stream, about why Carl, at Carl the Fog, the Twitter handle, prefers a daily city, why we get rainfall at night. Lots of fascinating and interesting connections coming in as we talk about what's going on with weather, including other aspects of weather that we'll take up with Jen Null when we return, including the interesting work that he has done in heat stroke. He has an interesting story to tell about that and how to prevent those tragedies from occurring in cars. We do want to hear from you. Here are the numbers. Here's how to reach us. You can call us at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. You can email us at forum@kqed.org. You can also post your questions on our website, kqed.org/forum, or on our Facebook page as well. And by way of going to the break, brief story. Tell us about your most important forecast, the forecast you had to do for your outdoor wedding.
Yes, I got married about 8 years ago, and it was around Thanksgiving time in the South Bay. And it was the one task I had was to make sure that it did not rain that day.
And?
It did not.
So if you need Jan Null for forecasting for your weather for your upcoming wedding, you can consult with him and Golden Gate Weather Services as well. More with Jan Null when we return as part of our first person series. Join us at 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org. I'm Dave Iverson in this week for Michael Krasny, and this is Forum on KQED. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson in this week for Michael Krasny. Jan Null, the well-known legendary meteorologist here in the Bay Area, is our guest. We're talking about the art and science of forecasting, the appearance of El Nino-driven storms, what they may portend for our winter this year in the Bay Area, and all things meteorological. We'll talk about fog and a variety of other things as the rest of our program progresses. We'd love to get more of your questions as well. We have a stack of them in front of me that we'll get to, and you can join us too at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Before we get to more of our questions and emails, Jan Null, I want to ask you something about the decision you made, I guess, 10, 15 years ago, when you decided to leave the Weather Service, perhaps a bit more than that, and National Weather Service, and start your own company. I never think of being a weather forecaster as something you could stake out as your own business, but you have in a very unique and interesting and successful way. What drove that decision? What has it allowed you to do?
Well, you know, the decision was driven by the fact that the National Weather Service moved out of the San Francisco Bay Area down to Monterey. Still, I think one of the most tragic things to happen in local meteorology. They're very distant from what we do up here. I commuted from the Fremont area down to Monterey for about 3.5 years until the middle of the El Nino of 1997-98. And at that time, they were just winding down some opportunities for early retirements. And I go, yeah, sounds like a good idea.
Hmm.
And so January 1st, 1998, I began Golden Gate Weather Services, which is a consulting company. I don't do a lot of forecasting. I do mostly consulting for engineering companies. I do consulting for attorneys and insurance companies as an expert witness. I get to do research about El Nino. I do research about heat stroke and children in cars. And I end up talking to the media a lot.
And I read that you have been an expert witness in something like 350 different court cases. I had no idea the weather was on trial that often. I mean, what do you wind up testifying about?
Well, and actually that number is closer to 420 at this time. A lot of times when there is a weather-related incident, let's say a tree falls across a highway and tragically kills someone, there's probably going to be an insurance claim. There may be the injured parties are going to want to sue the person that owned the tree, saying, well, okay, well, maybe they didn't take care of the tree. Or the other side is going to want to say, well, you know, this was the strongest storm in history. We never could have anticipated that. So I'm then brought in to look at, well, what were the wind speeds that day? Maybe how saturated was the ground? And then how unusual were those events? Was it a normal sort of windstorm where, you know, it occurs a couple times every year, you know, 30 or 40 miles an hour, which are fairly often around the Bay Area? Or was it something really strong where we had 70 or 80 mile an hour gusts? So I need to go back and dig through the meteorological archives and find out what the past weather is. As my wife likes to say, I do CSI weather. I go through and I reconstruct past weather events for either civil or criminal litigation.
Just so long as, and I hope you haven't been called upon to do this yet, to testify in a court case that involves one spouse suing another for the forecast not being true on their wedding date.
I haven't been contacted for one of those. I did have a case, though, where it was had to do with a divorce of two attorneys, and one didn't want the other spouse to move their child to an area that they thought had more fog. So it can be almost anything.
Well, we have a couple of fog questions. Let me dig through them and find them, and we'll go with fog for a moment or two, and then we'll get to more of our calls and questions. Sonia writes in, I've always wondered why sometimes we get a blanket of fog and sometimes white fog hugs the bay. What makes the difference? And also, where can I take a meteorology class?
Okay. As far as the types of fog, mostly what we have in summertime, that gray blanket of fog, a layer of stratus, forms off the coast over the cold waters, and then the sea breeze brings that inland. And stratus means flat layer. And so that comes in, you know, typically 800, 1,000, 1,500 feet above the ground. So it's an overcast layer. In wintertime, though, especially in the interior valleys, at night, when we've had moist air and the air and the sky is clear, the ground cools off and we get that condensation right on the ground. So we get that radiation or tule fog, as it's called, on in the interior valleys.
Here's a question from Ada, who asks, why does at Carl the Fog, that Twitter personification of fog, seem to prefer Daly City and the Outer Sunset?
That same cold water that I just mentioned, as far as the formation of the stratus, as the sea breeze blows that inland, first of all, one of the first places it gets to is Daly City. But you also have, as it comes over from the flat Pacific, it starts rising up over that narrow part of the coast range. It lifts up enough so you can get a little bit of increased condensation. So you get a little bit more fog there. It's also fairly windy through that San Bruno Gap area. And so that, you know, not only leads to it being probably one of the foggier places, but places where the fog occurs sooner and it's kind of cooler and blustier, so it's a lot more noticeable.
I wonder if that's connected to Matt's next question, which is what causes the uplift at Fort Funston, so just a little further south from Daly City or that same area. Those are those breezes where we see the hang gliders floating off of the cliffs there.
That's exactly the same phenomenon. The winds are blowing across the flat Pacific, and then they encounter the coastal bluffs there at Fort Funston and other places up and down the San Francisco and San Mateo coast. And so that air is forced upward and produces these very consistent upward wind currents that the hang gliders there like to ride.
One more fog and wind-related question, then we'll go back to some of our calls. Lou writes in, as temperatures rise due to climate change, will the Bay Area experience more foggy days because of the sea air differential in temperature?
You know, it's somewhat of a controversial forecasting question because the sea breeze that drives the fog pattern that we've been talking about is driven by temperature differentials. But during global warming, the biggest temperature change is more with the overnight temperatures. We are, you know, the greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, they trap that outgoing radiation at night so we don't cool off as much. So the warming at night is about twice as much as it is during the day in some of the ongoing sorts of scenarios with global warming. So as far as the sea breeze might increase a little bit, but probably not significantly. So it's probably going to end up being a wash as far as the fog goes.
Jen Null, again, our guest this hour, we welcome your calls and emails. We have stacks of emails here that we will try to get through and some calls as well. Let's go back to our calls for a moment and get a call from Jack, who joins us in San Francisco. Jack, go ahead, please.
Thanks, Dave. As you mentioned earlier, it just seems to me that I'm seeing much more extreme weather than I remember a decade or two or three decades ago. Read some articles recently about the rising waters, rather the rising oceans in Florida coming, the potential huge earthquake in the Pacific Northwest. I'm just wondering, historically, are we at a tipping point? Are we at a point in the Earth's history where it's only going to get worse and we need to start looking at, you know, 100, 200 years from now, what we're going to do as, you know, a human species to stay alive. Thanks.
Jack, thank you.
You know, a lot of that goes into sort of the perspective of what some of these extreme events. One, we're much better at capturing those. You know, someone has a cell phone of every tornado that's occurring now. We're seeing a lot more of the severe weather in real time. The jury is still out as far as, you know, for example, what the recent hurricane seasons, have those been increased? The earthquake mentioned has nothing to do with meteorology, nothing to do with climate change. So that's a non-starter. But I think we're a long ways away from the alleged tipping point. I mean, again, this is all going to be gradual, incremental sorts of changes. Seen probably the sea level rises have been very subtle, but they are there, and a few inches added to a normal high tide can just get over those barriers that were built with minimal clearance.
Are you beginning to get, I would think you are, consulting opportunities, people wanting to know about how to prepare for some of what Jack is concerned about, or you know, where does it make sense to install solar, or, you know, should we be building a reservoir, or whatever it happens to be, because there's so much angst right now about climate and water and rain, of course, particularly here in the Bay Area. I mean, it's got to be good for business, right?
Yeah, you know, that really is not, you know, in the sweet spot of the business that I have done. I have done some stuff for solar companies and for wind energy companies that are looking for looking at optimizing renewable sorts of resources, but not really some of those other broader questions.
Questions about forecasts in particular coming in. Let's start from one from inside KQED here. Craig Miller, our science editor, sends in this question. Can you ask Jan why he is so skeptical of NOAA's three-month outlook? That's the, I forget, NOAA's the National Oceanographic, and give me the rest
Atmospheric
of the
Atmospheric Administration.
Okay. Why are you so skeptical of their three-month outlooks?
Well, I'm not only skeptical of NOAA's three-month outlook. I'm skeptical of any of the long-range forecasts out there because they have not shown any skill. For example, last winter, especially people who are familiar with what happened in Boston, they predicted about a normal winter back there.
Yeah,
was anything but normal. There's just lots of cases where those 3 month forecasts just are not credible. And whether it's the Farmer's Almanac, NOAA, there's no one has shown any skill. And if you think about what the impacts of the weather are upon the economy, something like $500 trillion of the U.S. economy is weather sensitive. So if someone really had the answer to long range forecasting, they would be a very rich man with a lot of people lined up at their door, wanting their product. That person is not out there.
So tell me something then about the differentiation between that challenge and something which seems more predictable like El Nino, because we've been saying, at least people like you and others have been telling us for a long time, that the El Nino-driven storms will happen, it will be big, and it is now happening, and it does appear to be big. So how can you be good at that but not so good at those other questions?
Well, when we're looking at El Nino, we are looking at, how much the water is going to warm over this big area. We're not looking at the individual details of storms coming from that El Nino. That's why myself and other experts have, really couched our comments about this coming season, saying, okay, what we're looking at is based upon the climatology, what has happened in the past, not saying it's necessarily a forecast. It's just like we wouldn't say that, the average temperature on January 23rd in San Francisco is 68 degrees. So therefore, that's the forecast.
Yeah.
And the same thing with these climatologies and looking at what's happened with El Nino in the past, that gives us an indication and sort of a leg up in the right direction. But there's a lot of other stuff going on in the atmosphere. One of the slides that I show in my classes about El Nino, the very first slide, it says it's complicated. Because not only is El Nino happening right now, you have a whole alphabet soup of other atmospheric phenomenon. There's a North Atlantic Oscillation and the Manjulian Oscillation and the Pacific Takato Oscillation, and they all interact together. Now, El Nino is the big player in the game, so it sort of is a superstar in the team. But on any given night, some of these other players may have a really good evening.
Does that mean that in some ways, forecasting, be it short term or long term, is especially complicated in a place like the Bay Area? You'd think it would be simple in some ways. It's warm most of the time, and now and again it rains. But we have all of our microclimates. You were telling me earlier that we're still not very good at predicting whether or not fog is going to shut down SFO, which has lots of economic consequences. So what makes this – does this area become then particularly tricky, and are there economic consequences because of that?
Yes and yes. There are lots of subtle things going on in the Bay Area which are difficult to forecast. Unlike, for example, tracking a thunderstorm rolling into Kansas City, that's a pretty big dynamic feature that you can track, you can time out. Well, trying to figure out what time is the stratus going to clear at SFO so they can start doing side-by-side landings and have more traffic in and out has a huge daily impact upon what the what the outcome is of that particular forecast. So that's a very subtle thing. You need to be looking at, at satellite imagery and temperature changes and where the inversion was and things like that. Things that we aren't the best at yet at being able to get all the observational data to be able to model that. Our models tend to be a little bit grosser scale. So those subtle things make forecasting in the Bay Area fairly difficult.
So coming back to our caller earlier in the first part of our program, who wanted to know how to interest his son more, find websites or sources for his son to kind of further that interest. as you look ahead at something that might be something important to focus on for people who have interests or might aspire to go into this area, is it long-term forecasting? I mean, is that sort of where the action might be, where the biggest differences could occur?
Yes, as far as changes in forecasting skill, we've only seen relatively incremental changes in the short-range game. When I began as a forecaster in the mid-1970s, about a two-day forecast was sort of the limit of a good forecast. I've been in this now about four decades, and we're now up to about a 5 or a 6 day forecast. So we've added about 1 day in forecast ability per decade. But the bigger changes are going to be in that second week, being able to forecast what's going to happen, you know, not in the first 7 days, but in that second 7 days. We've been seeing that with the forecast models already this winter with the current storms. There tends to be a lot of variation on out in that second week. Some of it is not coming to fruition. The models just don't have, you know, have enough information, enough skill at forecasting that. And those are the evolutions that we hope to see with greater computing power, which is really what drives these forecast models as we go on into the next decade.
Let's see if we can drive our way through a bunch of questions and emails and tweets that have been coming in over the course of our hour. Nick writes in, please ask Jan about the La Nina that is supposed to appear next fall that could put us right back into a dry pattern.
Sure. Well, and this often happens after an El Nino. The warm water in the eastern Pacific will slosh back to the west, and then we have cooler than normal water, which is what is characterized as La Nina. But just like El Nino, there's really no guarantees with a La Nina that it's going to be a dry year. Actually, here in the Bay Area, it's almost a coin toss during La Nina years. Will it be wet or dry or normal? So it's really not a really good sort of indicator. So trying to then equate that into getting back into a drought, I think, is way premature at this point.
Laura tweets, I've always wanted to know why we seem to get so much of our rainfall at night.
You know, there have been some studies that there is a little bit more rainfall at night. But, I mean, we're talking at, you know, probably single-digit percentages. Mm. But the atmosphere is quieter at night. People are in their homes where they hear the rain at night, and so it's probably as much a perception that you're hearing the rain and you don't have all the other noises going on around it at night.
I want to come back just for a moment, if we might, to when you were talking about the kind of cases that you get called into judging whether or not a storm might be the cause of a tree that falls and causes an accident. You were also called in once or were asked a question about a tragedy that occurred in the South Bay, I believe, when a child was accidentally left in a car and died. And the reporter wanted to know, like, well, how hot was it? And that spurred this whole area of research for you and a kind of cause that became important.
Yes. I describe it as my passion project. Back in 2001, I was asked by local media how hot could have gotten this car after a five-month-old child died in a car in San Jose. And like everyone, even then, we had Google. I said, well, I can Google that. Someone's done a study. Well, nobody had really done a comprehensive study. So I started keeping track of temperatures in my own vehicles that year. I did a controlled study the next year looking at a whole range of days from 76 to 96 degrees here in the Bay Area, and eventually published that study along with a couple ER doctors from Stanford in the Academy of Pediatrics. And that was the first really peer-reviewed article that's such a broad range of temperatures, and sort of took on a life of its own. I became an expert in that field, and that study is now used worldwide. And I'm now involved with a lot of child safety groups in raising awareness about heat stroke in children that get left in cars. On average, there have been 37 children die each year in the United States. Literally an epidemic every year of children being left or getting into or being forgotten in hot cars.
And the way in which temperatures escalate, I was startled when I read this, that on an 80-degree day, within an hour, the temperature in the car goes up to what?
On a on an 80-degree day, we're at close to 125 degrees inside a car. And most of that rise, over half of that rise is in the first 10 minutes.
Wow. So important thing, of course, to be tuned into and to be aware of. Ross asks, what about the nuclear waste in the Pacific from Japan? Does that have any effect on the quality of the rainwater we're receiving?
No, you know, I have not seen anything about as moisture evaporates off the ocean, that it is also carrying any, you know, radioactive isotopes on up in any significant numbers above background levels into the rain that reaches California.
Question from Dom coming in from Milpitas. Dom, go ahead with your question, please, for Jen Null.
Yeah, I just wondered, would it be possible for us really to control things like rainfall so that we wouldn't have it like during the busy times of the day when we have commutes and stuff like that? You know, it'd be wonderful if we could have it rain, say, for 2 or 3 hours between, let's say, 2 and 5 or 2 and 6 a.m. when the streets are relatively vacant and everything could be washed to the curb.
All right. Thank you, Don.
Yeah, you know, there have only been sort of, you know, very minor looks at trying to, you know, impact up what, you know, what the amount of rain and the timing will be of rain. I know there are projects back in the Vietnam era of trying to impact when, you know, to make it rainier in those areas. But the amount of energy and power in the atmosphere really dwarfs any sort of manned effort. So we're never going to be able to control the weather is the bottom line.
Stephen comes back to something that's kind of come and gone throughout our conversation today, and that's the long-term effect of global warming on ocean temperatures and whether that will affect the number of El Nino events that we get in the long term.
Yes, that is probably going to be one of the first impacts we're going to be seeing are the, the atmosphere and the oceans have both warmed. And since we measure El Nino by the ocean temperature, we are going to then, by default, we're going to be having more of these anomalous years when we get that warming in the eastern Pacific and what we define as an El Nino. Now, it may be that we need to readjust that standard that we use of what we call a weak or a strong El Nino just because we're going to have a different baseline. That remains to be seen.
Question about the way the jet stream works. Martin writes, looking online on the North American Mesoscale Forecast System, a service of NOAA, it shows the jet stream currently running through Mexico. If storms follow the jet stream, then why is it raining in Santa Rosa?
Well, you know, the storms don't just follow right on the jet stream. That is the where the strongest winds are, what you're seeing that are depicted on those maps. But that storm track and the fact it's in that lower latitude is, again, very typical of what we see during El Nino. But those waves on the jet stream, even if it's down there, extend all the way up to the Oregon border and northward.
Question from Carol. You mentioned this earlier, and Carol wants to follow up with it, which is to further explain the Pacific Oscillation and its significance.
Sure. The Pacific Oscillation Index, or actually it's Pacific Decadal Oscillation Index, is this sort of large El Nino effect where you have the Pacific Ocean periodically on the scale of every 25 years, 20 to 30 years, gets warmer for that period of time, and then it gets colder. So years when you have it in that warm phase, then the El Niños tend to be stronger during those years. So again, the ocean temperatures are a really important clue to a lot of what's going on.
You mentioned earlier that the heat stroke cause and prevention of those issues for children has become a passion project for you. We just have a minute or so left. I'm curious about, finally, what your other passions are. You've had this wonderful career in meteorology here in the Bay Area. What do you still most want to do?
Well, you know, I think probably, you know, the other hats that I've worn over the years is one is as an educator. You know, I love talking about the weather. I love explaining it. I teach one night a week at San Jose State, a meteorology class. And I know there was a question about that earlier. And most of the community colleges and San Francisco State all have, you know, one night a week sorts of classes in meteorology. I encourage people to take those. So, you know, I always see myself, you know, trying to explain what's going on with the weather. And then my other passion is photography. And as a meteorologist, it really melds very well into, you know, looking, okay, here's a cloud pattern. Weather pattern is going to give me really great clouds for this sunset next week when there's a full moon. So, you know, it's nice to be able to tie all those things together.
You could do photography forecasting. I bet a lot of amateur photographers would really appreciate that.
I actually have some people I've photographed with that I often get calls from.
Jen Null, thanks for all you do, all you continue to do. Pleasure to have you on Forum this morning.
It's been a pleasure being here. Thank you, Dave.
Forum is produced by Irene Noguchi, Tina Lorberg, Judy Campbell, and Susan Britton. Our engineer is Jim Bennett. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. We get online support from Don Clyde. The senior editor of Forum is Dan Zoll. I'm Dave Iverson in for Michael Krasny this week, and hope you'll join us again tomorrow when in our 10 o'clock hour we'll take up this fascinating question, when do you become an adult? And why are there so few grown-ups in San Francisco? That's our 10 o'clock hour topic tomorrow morning on Forum. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.